when I work with contractors, I want my contractors' agreements to be pretty simple because I don't ever want them to feel like they have to go get a lawyer in order to sign my contractor agreement. It does not need to be complicated, but it does need to have some magic language in there about the ownership of the intellectual property rights. Welcome to this week's episode of the Hourly to Exit podcast. I'm your host, Erin Austin, lawyer, mama of kid and doggy, tennis player, once and future trail runner, YouTube addict, and dreamer. I provide legal tips and bits for turning your expertise into recurring revenue, turning your time-intensive hourly-based business to one that is scalable and hopefully one day saleable is the journey from hourly to exit. This podcast is for experts, consultants, coaches, and other professional services providers with sophisticated corporate clients. If you're investing in the growth of your business, you need advice and resources that address the issues that set you apart from other service-based businesses. Those templates for online businesses don't mean a thing when your client sends their 50-page master services agreement to you for signature. Stop playing small because you don't know how to protect your ideas. Hourly to Exit is here to show you how to navigate the maze of contracts and intellectual property issues so that you can safely and profitably share your ideas with clients and with collaborators. Before we dive in, please remember that this podcast provides general information only. The content of this podcast should not be taken as legal advice for any individual case or situation. The information presented is not intended to be a substitute for professional legal consultation. Each legal situation is unique, and the laws and regulations can vary widely by location, and they do change over time. For specific legal advice regarding your individual circumstances, please consult with a qualified attorney who can address your specific needs. Now, let's get started with today's topic. Hello, everyone. Welcome to this month's LinkedIn Live. I do these every last Wednesday of the month. I can't believe it's going to do that at noon Eastern. These are recorded and they can be found in three places here, of course, on LinkedIn at my profile on the Think Beyond IP YouTube channel. And this will also be turned into a podcast episode of the Hourly to Exit podcast, which you can find wherever you like to listen to my podcast. And so depending on how cleanly this goes, this will be the version. Otherwise, I'll probably re-record it. Please feel free to say hi at any time. Also, put your questions or comments in the chat at any time. I might answer them at the moment, or I will save them to the end of my spiel. So I will talk to you for about 15 to 20 minutes, depending how quickly I talk. And then after that, all the Q&A time that you need. And just a brief disclaimer before we get started that this is legal information, not legal advice, and it does not create an attorney-client relationship. And please do not share any confidential information in the chat that everyone will be able to see it. And if you have any questions about your specific circumstances, then you should hire a lawyer. All right, great. So with that, this is basically a follow-up from last month's LinkedIn Live. So last month, I covered a collaboration when we want to collaborate with a colleague, but what the consequences are if we don't have an agreement in place. When I was titling this, I know it says accidental collaboration, I'm pretty sure on LinkedIn Live, but kind of happened organically during a conversation with someone. They mentioned a circumstance like, oh, that's an accidental collaboration. And so that became the title of this live. And then as I was putting these slides together, I was just looking at, oh, is that a term of art? And it turns out accidental collaboration is a term of art, but it's considered a good thing. So what happens when you are meeting in person, an argument for having in-person work environments that you can just kind of organically collaborate with your colleagues, whereas the unintentional collaboration is the bad kind where we believe that we're hiring a contractor to work on some of our work, but we don't have an agreement in place and we think we own everything because we hired them to create these changes or add this content. But when we don't have the agreement in place, we can end up with an unintentional collaboration. So that is what we are going to talk about today. So I'm not going to go over all of the details of what collaborations are. You can catch up and you don't need to see last month's to understand this one. But generally, the term collaboration is not a copyright term. It's a general term that we use when we talk about two or more people working together to a similar end, whether it's creating a new work or putting together a summit or creating a new company. Those are also called collaborations. But under copyright law, how copyright law looks at collaborations is that it calls them joint ownership of a work. And so there's a couple of different terms. You'll find it under co-ownership, co-author, joint author, joint authorship, co-copyright, joint work. Those all are the result of a collaboration in the creation of a copyrighted work. And the consequences of being one of those things, a joint work, co-copyright, all those, is that, and it's a little bit weird, but each party owns 100% of the entire work. There's two of you, one owns 50%, the other owns 50%. There's three of you, one owns a third, a third, a third. Each collaborator owns 100% of the work. So what does that mean? That means that each party to the collaboration can exercise 100% of the copyrights on their own without consent of the other parties. And so when we think about what copyrights we have, what are the bundle of rights that we have when we are a copyright owner? It's the right to use it, to display it, to perform it, to distribute it, to make copies of it, and to authorize derivatives of it. So if I am one of several joint owners, each one of us can do all of those things, some or all of those things, independently without the consent of the other authors. You can sell outright your joint ownership to a third party. So now you're suddenly in a collaboration with someone that you might not even know. And of course, you can, well, because you can create derivatives, that means you can modify that work you created together for your own uses and license it to other people. And so the one restriction here is that you can't license exclusive rights to the work. So let's say you collaborated to write a book, and then even though you could license non-exclusively the rights to that book, you couldn't license exclusive rights to that book. So that's why we want to make sure we're really clear about what we're doing when we're creating collaboration. And to be clear, this is the default under the U.S. copyright law, which is why we want to make sure we have agreements in place to avoid this. And ignore my scratchy voice, it's okay. So how does a joint work, how does it get created? So it is created when each party makes a copyrightable contribution to the final work, and all of those contributors intend that their contribution is merged into an inseparable unitary whole. Let's talk about copyrightable contribution first. So in order for something to be copyrightable, we talk about this a lot, it has to be original, created by a human, and have some degree of creativity. It doesn't need to be unique and innovative, but it needs to be creative and then put in fixed form. But we're assuming that we're creating a work that's in writing or that's otherwise in fixed form. So long as it meets those fairly low standards, and low standards is the wrong way to put it, but basic standards, the contribution would be copyrightable. And so we would meet the first element of creating a joint work. Each party create something that is copyrightable. So let's say one person, well, the example I used last month, I'll use that for just a second, where one party created the text to a children's book and the other party created the illustrations to the children's book. And so each of them, the text and the illustrations are each copyrightable. And then for part two, that they intended them to be merged into an inseparable unitary whole. Like obviously, when we're talking about like a children's picture book, the pictures and the text are all kind of inseparable, right? And so the intent is to create a joint work in that example. So I want to use an example that would apply to perhaps an example of something that you've come across in your own business. And here I'm writing a book about the importance of intellectual property in creating a business that can scale. And let's look at two circumstances of creating an unintentional collaboration. First, let's say I hire a translator to create a Spanish language version of my book. So I am presenting my copyrighted work, right? I'm hiring him. I am telling him, I need this by this deadline. This is how much I'm going to pay you. These are the milestones. He'll have an invoice that invoices me and tells me how many revisions there will be. And everything happens the way it should be. He creates the translation. He makes all the revisions I ask him to make. And then at the end, we have our beautiful Spanish language version of my book. However, I don't have a contractor agreement in place with him. I might have an invoice, but I don't have a contractor agreement in place with him that talks about who owns the right in that Spanish language version. So do we have a joint work? So let's go back to this. Each person makes a copyrightable contribution. I made my contribution of my book. The translator made the contribution of the Spanish language translation. Now, is that original? There, people will debate this, but generally, it is found that translations are original and creative because it's generally not as simple as sticking it through some sort of translator. And the same intent comes through, that there is some creativity required to make sure that certainly a book about intellectual property, you can't just do a word-for-word translation to make sure that the understanding and the intent is maintained. If you think about the translation of a poem, which I was thinking about this, I'm like, how would you even translate a poem? Translating the Iliad, I mean, my goodness. So there's certainly creativity involved in there that would rise to the level of a copyrightable contribution. So I've got two people who have made copyrightable contributions to the final work, and it is the intent that is merged into an inseparable unitary whole. Not my English language version, but the Spanish language version is a inseparable whole. And so what I have done by not having an agreement in place with my translator, even though I hired him and paid him, is I have created a joint work in that Spanish language version. It is a jointly owned by me and my translator. That's obviously a huge problem for the reasons that we mentioned. Now let's go to my second example. Here, I've got my book, and like many business books, you will have interspersed in there some real life examples of clients and things like that. So I hire a ghostwriter to interview my clients and kind of write those stories that are going to be interspersed within my book. And like my translator, hopefully I would never do this, but in this example, once again, I've hired my ghostwriter. We agree that she's going to interview 10 clients and that each of the stories will be 300 words or so, and that I will pay her Y and she'll deliver them by Z. All goes as planned. Who owns my original English language book after this? So let's go back. Each has made a copyrightable contribution. I have my draft pre-story insertion, and then I have the stories that my ghostwriter has written. And it is intended that this all become part of that same book. It is being merged into my book, interwoven within my business book. So what have I done? I have created an unintentional collaboration where my book is now jointly owned with my ghostwriter. And so you might be asking, well, what if it's a 100-page book, 80 of the pages were your original draft, 20 of the pages are from the ghostwriter, so is it 80-20? No, because we covered already that each joint owner owns 100% of the copyright. So my ghostwriter could, if she never wants to work again, could take my book and license it, not exclusively, to a third party. And so it doesn't matter how much someone contributed to it. It is the copyrightable contribution and the intent to merge it into a single whole that drives whether or not you've created a joint ownership in the work. And so as ugly as that is, and it is very ugly, obviously, I mean, it's a disaster, honestly. It would be a disaster. But if we are land in the world of joint ownership. If one does act unilaterally and licenses, does that non-exclusive license, they do have to split it with the other joint owner. So they can't run off and license it and then pocket the money. It would be split equally among the joint owners. Again, this assumes that this is the default and no agreement is in place. And as I mentioned, that you can't grant exclusive rights or sell the whole work outright without the consent of the other joint owners. It is super important before any creative work begins that you have your contractor agreement in place. Do not let fear of contract stop you from doing this. I mean, it does not need to be complicated at all. I am of the school that the simpler it is, the better it is, because I want everyone to understand it. And I want my contractor's agreements to be pretty simple, because I don't ever want them to feel like they have to go get a lawyer in order to sign my contractor agreement. It does not need to be complicated, but it does need to have some magic language in there about the ownership of the intellectual property rights. And I'm realizing now I do not have a slide about that magic language, but I'm happy to provide it to anyone who asks for it. But basically, we want to make sure that no matter how simple our agreement is, we will have language in there about who owns the intellectual property rights in the deliverable. So in my translator agreement, I would have language in there that says that I'm the client, that the client will own 100% of the intellectual property rights in the deliverable, which is the Spanish language version. If you've been around here a while, you know we have the work for hire language and the assignment language, that which is belts and suspenders, to make sure that you end up with all the rights. And the same would apply to my ghostwriter as well. With that, I would be happy to take any questions. You can always find me on LinkedIn, which I'm assuming is where you are watching this. If we're not connected already, please feel free to connect with me. But this QR code, this is kind of fun. It's my first time using this, and it takes you to sign up for my newsletter, I believe. So I do have a weekly newsletter where I give additional tips and strategies regarding building your business legally, safely, and profitably. So again, if you have any questions, feel free to reach out. Let's see, I do have one here. I find that contractors take advantage when there isn't a contract. They're looking for loopholes. Yeah, so if you are the client and you are engaging contractors, you need to take advantage of the contract. You're the one who has the most to lose here. So make sure you're using a contract. It can be very simple, as I mentioned. Again, if it's simple, there should not be any loopholes. One of the things I did not mention is that while the copyright law says if I don't have an agreement in place, then we are joint owners. And that is the case if it comes to it. At the end of the day, most people who don't understand it, they feel that if I was paid for something, then my client owns it. And that usually holds. I imagine there's lots of the joint works out there in the world that people aren't aware of. But again, hopefully the relationship is strong enough and their reputation in the marketplace is strong enough that they aren't looking to take advantage, that they want to have repeat business, they want to have referrals. And so hopefully that will keep everything kind of civilized. All right. Thanks again. Enjoy the rest of your day. This week's episode of the Hourly to Exit podcast is sponsored by the NDA Navigator. Non-disclosure agreements, also known as NDAs, are the bedrock of protecting your ideas and your business's confidential information. Of course, I recommend that you have a lawyer review any agreement before you sign it. However, facing a constant stream of NDAs can be overwhelming, especially when time and budget constraints prevent you from seeking full legal review. That's where the NDA Navigator comes in. Designed specifically for entrepreneurs, consultants, and business owners with corporate clients, the NDA Navigator is your guide to understanding, negotiating, and implementing NDAs. Empower yourself with legal insights and practical tools when you don't have the time or funds for a full legal review. Get 20% off by using the coupon code H2E at protectyourexpertise.com. Thank you for joining me for another episode of the Hourly to Exit podcast. Don't forget to check out the show notes for the resources and organizations mentioned during the episode. If you find the podcast to be valuable, please subscribe so you get notified of new episodes every week. And I would be so grateful for a rating and review, and it helps get the word out. See you next week.